Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. And today we welcome back a regular guest, Alan Steele from Scotland. Hello, Alan.
Good afternoon.
And how are you doing, Alan?
Best not to ask.
that bad, is it?
But yeah, being, you know, it seems to me that we have in Scotland a First Minister who reminds me of, and I've discussed this with others, it reminds me of when I was a wee bairn at school, and every now and again you got a torn-faced teacher who kept telling you that if you didn't behave yourselves, they would keep you behind and give you extra homework. And and that's how I feel at the moment.
Right.
I just feel we've got a torn-faced school teacher in charge.
Yeah, I think what it is, Alan, in England, they put a variety of people to lead the conversations every day in the press conferences, you know, various cabinet ministers, whereas in Scotland, we just get Nicola every day for an hour. So it's getting a bit.
Oh, right.
But yeah, because sometimes you get Boris, sometimes you get Matt Hancock. I'm trying to think, sometimes it's the Chancellor. So it's kind of varied down in England, whereas in Scotland, we're just.
You've got the headmistress.
Got the headmistress, yeah, all day, every day, and you better not misbehave. But
At least we've got Jane Godley.
Yeah, she does. I don't think Mark will be aware of her, but she does do a good voiceover of the press conferences. I might actually put a couple up on our Fairbairn and Russell page when we put this podcast out, Alan, because she's quite funny. We need to find ones where she doesn't swear too much, because some of them it's a bit excessive. But I'm looking at one of your tweets, Alan, from it's probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago, and it says, anyone else noticed that an anagram of coronavirus is virus or a con?
Mm.
Would you like to expand on that?
Well, it's interesting. A long time ago, I dabbled around a long time ago with astrology. People will now switch off, I suppose, but I found it quite interesting. And I remember there was a woman called Linda Goodman, and she used to write books on sun signs and stuff like that. It was pretty heavy stuff. And she wrote another book about star signs and stuff. And in that, she went through various things like numerology, and she came across this thing called lexigrams. And lexigrams are the secret meanings of words by looking at the words inside the words, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. And of course, the ultimate of that is an anagram. An anagram is a lexigram using all the letters of the word. And I thought, I wonder if there's an anagram of coronavirus. And it just came flying out. I mean, it's like virus or a con. That's exactly what coronavirus makes up. And you just ask yourself, is this really the incredibly serious pandemic that everybody, not everybody, but the people who the governments are listening to have been telling us? But we are now into this by a few weeks, aren't we? And you would think that they would be using some of the statistics that they already have. But the problem is the statistics are all over the place. What's a death rate? You know, how do they define a death rate? Because it seems to me that they don't know who's been tested, who's had it, who's not had it, and that sort of thing. So how can you build statistics out of that kind of information? It seems like they're completely flawed. And so that's why I came up with that. Interestingly enough, the day before that, when you're lying around bored and you're trying to think of things, I suddenly noticed. And here am I at 73 years old, and I never noticed this before. And I asked my wife the question. I've asked one or two people, and they actually look at me with a sort of empty face, you know. They look and go, no, I don't know. I just asked the question, what word do we use when we talk of, say, a document that has been tampered with for illegal purposes? What word, what verb do we use? Can you think of the verb?
Fraud? I don't know. Doctored? I don't know.
Correct. Absolutely. Got it in one.
Doctored, yeah.
Doctored. I mean, they don't say this document has been joinered. This document has been bricklayered. They say it's been doctored.
Yeah.
And that actually makes you think, because I can tell you there's something else that I discovered by talking to the local undertakers. But I know them pretty well. It's not as if I'm sort of getting organised to have a coffin or anything like that. And I was asking them what they think, and they're actually of the same view as I have, and most other people, including you by the sound of it. What they said was that for quite a few years, and I would imagine it's in, given what happened with the Shipman cases, you know, remember the doctor?
Yeah.
Harold Shipman. After all that happened, the rules were changed regarding death certification. And they have been consistently where when somebody dies, the first thing that has to happen is that a doctor who is well aware of the patient and the circumstances and the records actually then considers what the primary cause of death was. Then that has to be checked again with another doctor who then has to agree. So yeah. they put down the primary cause.
Mm-hmm.
That was dumped right at the beginning of this, apparently, whereas in order allegedly to get the data through quickly, they did away with that and said, sign a death certificate, doesn't have to know the patient, doesn't have to know the circumstances, and it's not then discussed by another doctor. So you've got a situation where doctors who have no idea about the patient are actually now completing the death certificate. And the undertakers told me that they were shocked by this because secondary causes of death are now being shown as primary causes.
Okay.
So if people think that it could be, this is somebody that's not even been tested. If they think it could be coronavirus or COVID, that's what goes down in the death certificate.
Mm. Okay.
So he said in his entire lifetime, he's never seen this before. And it's his view that the COVID deaths have been at least doubled over what they should have been. And he gave me some examples, and I'll give you one. 96-year-old woman, very frail, three or four things wrong with her, extreme dementia, could have died, as he said, with a cold. 96 years old, death certificate says COVID. And there are variations. I could give you loads of examples. One of Norman Hunter, the
footballer,
the Leeds legend. I think he was, 77 or something like that?
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember it, a few weeks ago. Died. It was in the press and the media as he died from COVID. And I discovered through my football contacts, who knew the people really well, knew the family and so on, that he'd suffered from leukemia for years.
Right, yeah.
So he's somebody who's weak, has an immune system shot to bits, and the cause of death is COVID. I mean, it beggars belief.
Yeah, so the numbers are skewed the wrong way, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean...
We also know for a fact, because it's now collected from all over the place, Spain, Italy, America, all over the place, in the UK... We know for a fact that something like 91% of the people who are dying allegedly with COVID are elderly with at least, I think the Office of National Statistics said, at least two, on average 2.7 serious pre-existing illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're all being shown as being COVID, and the rest of us are all locked up.
Right, yeah.
Does they add up?
Mm. So why are the government taking this route, do you think, Alan?
It's that wonderful word that I came across. There's two expressions. One is collective blindness. Another one is called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is a well-known factor amongst cults of scientists and politicians, economists and so on, who collectively have this theory that something is the case. And when it doesn't work or they're wrong, they don't admit they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll do anything but admit they're wrong. And I've got a great example of that if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
In November 2010, a group of renowned economists and top academics and leaders in business, that's how they were described in America. There was 10 of them, including Niall Ferguson, professor at Harvard, and eminent economists and so on, wrote an open letter to Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the US. That open letter was published in the Wall Street Journal. If you Google it, I believe it's still there. And what they said was that instead of thanking the man for saving the world financial system with quantitative easing or QE, they wrote to him and said that he should stop it immediately because it would lead to rampant inflation or hyperinflation. It would lead to higher interest rates. It would weaken the dollar and it would cause heavy extra unemployment in America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here we are, almost 10 years later. Were they right in anything they said? No, they were wrong in every single issue.
Mm-hmm.
We have lower inflation, we have lower interest rates, the dollar is stronger, and the unemployment in America until this latest farce fell heavily by millions.
Mm-hmm.
So they were wrong. Will they admit they're wrong? No. They came up, one of the economists said, well, when I said it was inflation, I didn't say what kind of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Another one said something like, well, I didn't say when.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a classic case of cognitive dissonance. And if you've got a situation here where you've got another Ferguson, same spelling, Neil, different spelling of Neil, professor at Imperial College. It was his model that predicted up to 500,000 deaths in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
A similar Harvard model predicted up to 2.5 million deaths in New York. Now, I can understand that if you are a government and you are a prime minister or a president, when you're faced with that kind of thing, then I think it's pretty understandable that you then take a great panic moves.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're right and you don't do anything about it, you can just imagine what would happen. So you can understand why that panic took place. But that panic included all sorts of things. I mean, what they did was they took 15,000 patients out of hospitals and put them into care homes without testing them.
Right, yeah, okay.
Then you wonder why it is that so many people appear to have died in care homes.
Mm.
Because let's face it, if you do go into hospital for anything these days and have an operation, they get you out there as fast as you can. So the people who were in the hospitals must have been pretty seriously ill. So they remove them. Nonsense. They then spend goodness knows how much money on these Nightingale hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Glasgow one apparently has never had anybody in it, and mm-hmm. it's mothballed.
Yeah.
The one in London had a maximum of 51 people in it.
Mm.
It was built to take 2,000 or 3,000. So you've got all that. Now you say, right, well, why is it that they're continuing with the evidence, the fact that obviously they were wrong with the predictions? I mean, 96% wrong, probably. Why is it that we will still not listen to others who have got different views? There's a very interesting guy writes for the Spectator. He's a retired professor of pathology called Dr. John Lee.
Mm-hmm.
He's worth listening to. He has said right from day one that this was an overreaction and it wouldn't be anything like as severe.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Hugh Pennington, you've got people like that, but they won't listen to it. And the sad thing is that you've got in SAGE, this scientific, what it's called, the SAGE, SAGE.
Yeah.
They're a bunch of clones. They're all of the same opinion as Ferguson. And there was an announcement because obviously Mr. Ferguson, Professor Ferguson, was a naughty boy and then had to resign. But a spokesperson for the SAGE committee said that they would be carrying on his good work. And you think, I can't believe that. I can't believe that. Because the research is out there that if you've got an economist and then you bring another five economists in, let's say, and they all believe the same thing, and they form a committee, that committee is going to reach a conviction that's wrong faster because they're all agreeing with each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the research that's been done in the Columbia Business School in America and Princeton University, and so there's been lots of research suggesting that when you're going to have, if you're going to have more than one person, that a team is actually a far better decision-making process than one person. But it has to have diverse skills.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't have diverse skills, there's no point.
Yeah.
And I can give you a great example of how we seem to have regressed in the last 78 years. Remember Bletchley Park?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bletchley Park was a collection of people put together in 1942 to mm-hmm. try and crack the Enigma codes, the German Enigma codes, which were causing so much damage to the British merchant shipping, et cetera, et cetera. And it was done on this alphabetic code. And the little, I can't remember what his name was, but it was Arthur, I think it was Arthur Dennison, I think the name. Wee Scottish guy was put in charge of it. And what he decided to do, he thought about it, and he decided it would be, rather than having a whole team of mathematicians working on this, he thought it was a good idea to get some really top wise people with diverse skills. And he included crossword fanatics in his team. So, and that team broke the code.
Yeah.
It's been described as probably the most significant thing that happened between 1939 and 45, and possibly the greatest British achievement in the 20th century. That was in 1942. Why haven't they done the same thing now? Why didn't they say, right, we'll take Dr. John Lee, we'll put him and so on, and we'll all discuss this and so on? It didn't happen. And when you look at Professor Ferguson's record, I don't know if you've looked at the record of his predictions in the past, but I mean, they are unbelievable. I mean, I have them somewhere because I did a letter from Linlithgow the other day and I laid them out. But in what was the first one? Foot and mouth disease?
Mm-hmm.
Foot and mouth disease. His model convinced the government to slaughter 12 million sheep and cattle because I can't remember the numbers, but he predicted something like 150,000 people dying. And I think 127 died.
Right.
The year afterwards, it was mad cow disease. He predicted so many thousand people would die with that, and it was something like 200. Same with SARS. He predicted millions worldwide. Oh, bird flu, that's a cracker. He predicted in bird flu there would be millions of people worldwide dying of it, and I think there was 200-odd people died.
Right.
Or it's a very small. I have the actual number in case somebody's listening and said, no, that's wrong. So this guy's got a record that's actually pretty appalling.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also admitted, apparently in March, that the computer code that predicted these incredible number of deaths was actually 13 years old and was put together for an entirely different purpose.
Okay.
So, I'm not actually making all this up. I mean, this is all in the public arena.
Yeah.
And yet we still go on. And it's this question of diversity. We, in our business, we try to find, first of all, in the company, we try to put people at senior level in the company who are not clones of me. There's no point.
Yeah, yeah.
If everybody's just going to agree with me, we're never going to progress. And so we can have some quite heated arguments. There are people in there that are, what you need is you need people who are wise. There's no point putting a bunch of numpties in. You need people who are wise, but you need that diversity. And we do that as a company. And we also try to find diversity in the fund managers that we try to locate as whether they're goalkeepers. I talked about that before, goalkeepers, the defenders and the attackers. You try to find staunch defenders and risk taking attackers, you know, exciting strikers, if you want, and you put these and you blend them together. And the fascinating thing is that that team approach, that diverse approach for our clients and for me personally, has actually so far delivered quite remarkable results.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite remarkable. One of the funds in my own pension plan since lockdown on the 23rd of March is up 47%.
Right.
And over 5 years, that same fund is up something like 130%. And just to give you an example, the situation, if you were in a UK index tracker over 5 years, you'd be lucky to be up 5%.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So instead of going for average, instead of going for clones, you go for wisdom, you go for diversity. And when you get things wrong, you admit you've got them wrong.
Yeah. So you haven't necessarily got a problem with the government taking that extreme stance initially, just in case it did happen. But is it more the fact that, you know, let's change our stance now, considering,
Well, I did take that view initially. I mean, I have had that view initially. I can understand what they did, why they did it. But what I don't understand now is why they didn't do due diligence on the predictive qualities of Ferguson and Imperial College before they took that decision.
Okay.
If they'd sat down and said, "Well, Professor Ferguson, what's your track record like? You know, what did you predict for foot and mouth disease and SARS? And you know, give us the details." And if they looked at that, they think it's like we've got a complete headbanger here. If you're actually going to buy a business, or do anything with a big expenditure, especially something as critical as this, don't you think it would be sensible to do due diligence?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? Yeah, yeah.
So that's my point, really. I just think when I look at what's happening, when I look at, I have family relatives who are nurses. ICU nurses in the local hospitals. Forth Valley Hospital last week had one COVID patient. Over the previous 8 weeks, they had a total of 12.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at St John's, which has got nobody, the same story is coming from Edinburgh Infirmary, the same story is coming from Fife, the same story is coming from up in Aberdeen.
Yeah.
So you've got all this. You talk to the undertakers. Are you busy? No, we're quiet.
Right.
We don't like the way in which we see these death certificates, which are complete baloney. We don't understand them. You think, well, why are we still having to go through all this?
Yeah.
And you look at some of the countries in Europe, Alan. Obviously, I was just checking up in Belarus the other day because they had quite a two fingers attitude to the virus. The president just said, drink more vodka and just get on with your life.
Yeah.
And 185 deaths. And initially I thought, well, Belarus has not really got that big a population. It's got double what Scotland's got. There's 10 million people in Belarus. Wow. And they've only had 185 deaths.
Hmm.
It just shows you the benefit of vodka.
I mean, I was going to say, like, maybe the government felt pressure, you know, to do this. But then you look at, like, as you just said, Kenny, or even Sweden, they didn't, you know, let's say, bend to any pressure of other Western nations doing the actions they did, and they seem to be faring better, don't they? Really?
Yeah.
And you look at Spain, and Spain got really badly hit.
Yeah.
But then there's a culture in Spain where generations all live together.
Yeah, exactly. Same in Italy. Yeah,
and they're always kissing each other and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
They're very
cuddly, kissy kind of culture, and they got really badly hit initially. And yet, a week ago, we got a message from I'm an Ibiza freak, and I know people in Ibiza. I know a lot of people in Ibiza, and I've known people for a long time in Ibiza. And our favorite little country restaurant. Last Thursday, we got a message saying, we're open.
Yeah, okay.
We're open. Now, they're not opening indoors, but then they've hardly got any indoors. It's mainly outside.
Yeah.
And the tennis courts were all open, and mm-hmm. the golf courses were open. And you go, well, why is it that everybody here has decided, no, we're just going to keep you locked in?
Mm.
I mean, what's the difference between walking on a golf course and swinging a golf club?
Here's a funny one for you. So one of my wife's friends, her husband actually sailed the Atlantic, about 3 or 4 months ago. There was a group of four guys, and collectively were the oldest people ever to row across the Atlantic. And he was out in Gair Loch, which is the bit of water, obviously, at Helensburgh.
Yeah.
And the police boat came out from Faz Lane, and basically they get ticketed and told not to get on the back and not to get back in the water until this was all is all over. And he was absolute raging because he's minding his own business and his canoe or his kayak, whatever it was, and he got huckled off the water and got given a warning and a ticket, probably a fine as well. I need to ask my wife, actually. It just seems mad.
It beggars belief.
Yeah.
You know, if you're out in the water, you've got nobody beside you. You've got fresh air.
Yeah.
You've got all that fresh ozone. You've got, with it sunny, you've got a bit of, you've got some vitamin D. I mean, just, I just don't get it. I really don't get it. And what I don't get is the gullibility of the Scottish people. The sad thing is we don't have that diversity. In the decision-making process, and we've got the First Minister just coming up and going, you're not going to, that's it, you're not going to, and you think, by the way, she lives in Uddingston, as I believe, so presumably she's being chauffeur-driven to the Scottish Parliament every day, and there's somebody's obviously doing her hair. I mean,
yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah, she's got a new style every day. That's about the highlight of the day.
It's one rule. It's one rule for them, and it's a completely different rule for everybody else. But the interesting, there are some good things out of this. So maybe we should, you know, given that my background is about financial planning and helping people to plan for retirement and make money and things like that, there are some interesting things. I was on a webinar the other day. Our favourite American fund is managed from Boston in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
There was a webinar with the fund manager. Now, this is a company that spend an enormous amount of meticulous time studying the businesses that they feel they would want to own as if they owned them before they put them in the fund. And they only have about 30-odd businesses in the fund. And they go for world-class businesses that they know and they study. They have 150 analysts studying these businesses. They have a wish list of about 150 companies at any one time. And they will spend years, 10 years, more, studying these companies, getting to know them before they buy them. And they'll buy them when they can get them as cheap as they possibly can. They mm-hmm. like a bargain and they like to have a purchase way below intrinsic value. So they do estimates on what the share price could look like in 5 years and in 10 years, and what kind of market, what products, what's the quality of the business, how strong is it, et cetera, et cetera. They spend a huge amount of time. And once they buy a business, they tend to stick with it. So they have, in the business, it's known as turnover, they have a very low turnover rate, about mm-hmm. 10%. In other words, they tend to hold a stock for 10 years.
Right.
Before they'll then say, right, well, we've got the best out of that, now we'll move on to something else. So they have a very, very low turnover rate. And what the guy was saying was, there are periods, they don't happen very often, but there are periods where a dislocation will come about, usually from left field. One example was 9/11, 2001, when the planes hit the buildings and so on, and it changed the way in which a lot of work was done and a lot of business was done. At that time, they actually acted, and I think they bought like five businesses. In 2008, which was the great financial crisis, when there was another huge dislocation, they bought eight businesses. And this time, they see it as the same dislocation. It came out of nowhere, a pandemic, whether it's right or it's wrong. It's they've stopped the world. The world economy's kind of just gone on kind of free fall. They've already made five purchases. And his view is that when you, after, in the years after such a dislocation, if you've made the right choices of the right businesses, you will make serious money.
Yeah.
And they gave examples of businesses that they bought. Another classic example came from a webinar that I listened to from Australia, from venture capital guys in Australia. It was fascinating. And they were going along the same sort of line, saying every now and again you get an opportunity. And he made a very interesting, that guy made a very interesting point. He said the first time he ever saw reports about, what's it called again? Try to think, but it's just going out of my head. Oh, yeah. First time he ever saw reports about working from home, not having to go into an office, you know, the paperless office, blah, blah, blah. He said the first time he ever saw that was in 1998. And he said, nothing's really changed very much until suddenly now. In 1999, he saw reports about predicting the end of malls, retail malls, and big department stores in 1999. And he said in 1999, the online retail business in America was 6% of total retail sales. He said in 2019, it was 17%. So it hadn't really gone up that very much over that 11-year period, over that 20-year period, I should say, 20 years. Mm-hmm. But since then, already in April, it was something like 26 or 27% of all retail was online. And he gave an even more amazing example, Zoom. I dare say you've been on Zoom conferences and so on.
Oh, yeah.
Zoom, he said in December 2019, which is, 5 months ago, the total number of Zoom subscribers was 8 million. In March, it was 200 million.
Yeah.
In April, it was 300 million. So if investors have an opportunity to turn away from the fear and the frustration and to look at what will be the next 10 years, what will the next 10 years look like? Because the winners of the next 10 years will not probably not be, with the exceptions of the Amazons and so on, there will be businesses that will have developed right now. Both of these guys made the same point, and they said is that when you get such critical dislocations, you get some seriously bright people who work even harder to find solutions to the problems. So there's an energy that comes in that wouldn't normally be there. So despite my frustration of what's going on in the politics and the cognitive dissonance and the lack of diversity and people covering their arse, basically, whilst that's the case, I do think, I hope I live long enough, but I do think that we will see some remarkable changes in the world. And I think the US, especially, and Asia, and emerging Asia, the Vietnams and Singapore, I think there will be dramatic performances coming out of these areas.
Okay.
So that's a brightness.
Yeah, well, you're always the optimist, aren't you, Alan? On our podcast, and I
it's
agree.
It's hard to be
at this time. Yeah,
it's hard to be when you're actually faced with so much incompetence.
Well, maybe, yeah, but you're right though. I mean, this morning I saw something on BBC. Theo Profitas had done an interview, and he said that retail will never ever go back to how it was before, and online will transform it. And there are opportunities there, aren't there? To go with the new
I do accept that, but I also feel that eventually what will happen, human beings like to be with other people, And I do think that whilst a lot of businesses will have failed, I mean, some of these highly leveraged Jamie Oliver type, restaurant type businesses, I mean, I don't think we'll see them again, I would imagine. I don't think they'll survive.
Okay, yeah.
But airlines will survive. I'll give you an example, actually. One of my friends who's got a home in Florida stunned me the other day by saying that he's managed to book up business class flights on United from Edinburgh out to Tampa via where it goes via Newark, I think. It goes Newark and then down to Tampa. £1,400 each. Now, you might think, oh, that's a lot of money. That actually, I think the last time I looked at it, you wouldn't get them under $3,500, you know. So
yeah, for business, yeah.
For business. And by the way, there will be half the people in business that would normally be in business.
Yeah.
Normally in business, there's two side-by-side seats. Only releasing one each. So
right, yeah, okay.
So that price at $1,400, you would have thought that as soon as they were offering these prices, they would be having to increase the prices. But no, what's happened is obviously they're so keen to get people to get back on flights that they're prepared to give discounts. So if there's anybody out there who's thinking of going to Florida in December or some of the end of the year and get a bit of sunshine, get on that website and see if you can't pick up some bargains.
Maybe we should think about it, Kenny, eh?
Yeah, holiday would be nice. But,
So what's the end game then, Alan? I know last time we spoke about, you know, you say we need to get away from these low interest rates and we need to get innovation back, you know, in the country and give people something to actually invest in. And that, you know, reading the book so far, I'm beginning to grasp the understanding of that.
Well, if you go back, let's go back to what Richard Koo said. Richard Koo has always said that when you do get a bad dislocation or a crisis, a financial crisis, the classic economics goes out the window, because economists always believe that you drop interest rates down and you encourage businesses to borrow.
Yeah,
again.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But what he also says is, in a situation like this, where businesses are actually ending up with serious debt, no matter what you do, they're not going to borrow money. They're just going to take whatever they can get to try and replenish their balance sheet.
Yeah, yeah.
And individuals who might be underwater because their house prices are falling, so they, no matter what you do with the interest rates, put them in negative if you want.
Yeah.
Put tax rates right down. People will just say, "No, I'm not going to
not
invest.
Gonna invest.
I'm going to get out of this debt." And there is evidence that people after the Great Depression in the 30s, they never invested again, ever.
Right. It's
They were so scared. It shocked them for their entire lives.
Yeah.
And what Koo basically says in situations like that is that governments have to become the investors, the last standing investors.
Right.
And they have to spend money, create money and throw it at infrastructure spending. And that appears to be what is planned for the US. They're talking about $1 trillion, which would create 30 million jobs. The UK would appear to be talking about the same, in the same vein. And so that, I think governments will probably, because they can borrow money, well, I think the UK has just issued a gilt with a negative yield and people have bought them. I mean, you think, who in their right mind would do that? For the private investor, if they think along the same lines as the venture capital guys, the people who are saying, well, look at the new businesses that will be created as a consequence of that, and they're prepared to take the risk and not be afraid, I think that this would be a great period of opportunity. And it's already been a great period of opportunity, because the most painful period in my life in the last few years was in March. After we came back from Tenerife and the markets were on waterfall, they were falling like a waterfall. And it was very painful. And you're sitting there thinking, my life savings are just going down the tubes. And it's a time when you feel inclined to go, well, I better be safe, I better get out of everything, just get any cash. And that's what a lot of people did. They got out of bonds, yeah, which were very secure, but any cash. But most of the funds that I own, well, one's up 47%, which is exceptional. But there's quite a few up 20-odd percent, 28%, since the 23rd of March. So in 2 months, there's been that dramatic increase. And the people who were afraid and felt the pain and got out into cash have missed that opportunity. Now, I don't know how long they're going to wait until they'll come back in again, but they will miss they'll miss the next 20-30%. And it will happen. And there are funds out there.
Right.
And you guys are actually kind of specialists in the kind of venture capital field, aren't you, really? They're looking at small businesses and special, like gold mining, and you know, I read up what you guys are doing in Alec and so on down south. But equally, there are some really, really good businesses that will do really, really well. And it's the strength. I think it was at Buffett that said, when the tide goes out, you find who's swimming naked. Well, there are people who are not swimming naked, and there's a lot, there are people, investors out there who've got cash. And there are opportunities.
So you see, I was talking to my dad about this because he's a business owner, and you know, there's a fair bit in the bank, I believe. And he was saying that, you know, if interest rates do go negative, then it would force the hand of a lot of people who have cash to invest it, because you'd be an idiot to leave it in the bank, because you'd be losing money on it.
But that's not what Koo says. I mean, what Koo says is that if people have been so badly shocked, even if you put interest rates into zero, if they're so afraid, they'll not move.
If the majority are still afraid, yeah, okay.
Yeah, they will. If they've got some mortgage or a debt, they'll just pay it off.
Yeah, sure, you know? Sure, yeah.
So it's always the minority.
Yeah, okay.
That are prepared to take the risk.
Right, yeah, okay.
Sadly.
And if the governments are going to lead the way in this with spending and QE, and are you still of the opinion that that's not really a problem? You mentioned earlier.
No, I don't.
Yeah, okay.
The alternative is that we go into a deep recession and the GDP just keeps falling.
Yeah.
In America in the 30s, GDP fell 46% mm-hmm. over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Americans at the time and the economists and the government didn't realise that they were in this balance sheet recession and didn't do anything about it until Hitler started to attack them. And it was at that point they did all the fiscal stimulus and infrastructure spending, built tanks and planes and so on. And if you remember what happened after the war, it was the golden era for most people.
Yeah, true.
They could get a mortgage, they could buy a house, you can buy cars, and they bought fridges and televisions and all that sort of thing. It was the golden era. Then it was created by that infrastructure spending.
Okay.
So if the UK government, and it would appear that they're going to go into, it's like things like building roads and sticking some bridges up and repairing bridges. And I mean, there's plenty of potholes to fill in.
And that'll all help to stimulate and encourage innovation and growth. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, you've got the innovation being created by the new things like work from home.
Online
retail spending.
All
that kind of thing. The technology. There'll be a technology explosion.
Right.
In the next 5 years that we've never seen before.
Okay.
That makes me positive. What doesn't make me positive is I'm stuck in my bloody house.
Yeah.
Is the wine collection diminishing though, Alan? That's the most important.
It gets replenished.
Keeps getting replenished, I think, doesn't it? Yeah.
it gets replenished. Fortunately, we've got a very understanding supplier not that far away at Champney Restaurant, and they've got a wonderful wine cellar. And for them to survive, they're basically selling off their wine. And so that suits me fine. And we've got a number. I tell you, the people who should be being applauded right now are the people that have kept us going. The local supermarkets, the butchers, the bakers, the bin men coming and emptying their bins, you know, the wee corner shops.
Yeah.
All these businesses should be applauded. I just hope that people will remember them and keep using them because they've been a lifeline.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. I've definitely shopped a lot more local, so I have since this has all kicked off. Through choice more than anything else. I mean, I don't think I've been out since lockdown. I've not been out of Helensburgh. No, not at all. So probably the furthest I've went is I've walked a couple of miles round about, and that's about it.
Yeah, so. Well, I have a business that I need to, whilst all my people are working remotely, we need it to be ticking over, and I need to do my research, and it's a lot easier doing my research on my system in the office because we've got really powerful broadband and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that in the mornings and wandering around. So I haven't driven very far. I've probably driven at most about 3 or 4 miles. And we've been going out walking and stuff like that. But it's boring. You can't. You just what you would do to have a pint. You know, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to go out and have a meal?
Yeah, you take these things for granted, and
you do. And I think that's one of the things you learn is that you kind of learn what's really important in life.
A thought for Friday thought, so it is.
Good
stuff. But I think that's probably about an hour we've been chatting. It just seems to fly in, so it does, Alan.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fine.
Really good to talk again, Alan. You sound better at the end of the podcast now than you did at the start. So maybe
that's your fault. You were asking me questions. You were asking me what was really bothering me and stuff like that. So then I had my little rant. But I do think that the whole situation is ridiculous. I can't understand why. Why they have groups of clones, they've got these scientists all think the same thing, rather than actually pulling together the disparate views, the diverse views of wise people with their own findings and their own research. Mm-hmm. But I just don't get why. Well, I do get it, because it's about cognitive dissonance. It's about governments not wanting to admit they were wrong.
Yeah,
and I actually think that's what it's about.
Mm.
And they're now persuading people that there might be a second wave and a third wave and all that. And people are scared, you know. I speak to people down at the local supermarket, and they're going like, but you know, you've got to do this because, you know. And I go like, well, you know, why do you think the hospitals are empty? Oh, well, I don't know about that. You know, that's not on the television. I go, of course it's not on television. But you don't hear on the television any alternative view. Although, interestingly, Dr. John Lee has been writing also in the Daily Mail, amazingly enough. So his points are being made strongly in the Daily Mail. That's an interesting move that's only about a fortnight old. So maybe we're starting to get some people starting to think, or some of the media starting to think, actually, there is another view here. Mm. I think they've got a very important part to play.
Mm.
Yeah, food for thought, so it is. Yeah, we'll keep an eye on your Twitter account over the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, I've been very quiet. You may have noticed.
Yeah.
I've been very quiet for a while because it was doing my head in. Because there was all it seemed to be full of pessimists, and I just thought, you know, this is doing my head in. So, I did a little tweet saying I'm going to take a wee break. And the other thing is that there seem to be so few people with a sense of humour. Because if I sent something out funny, people weren't picking it up and coming back with inane comments, and I thought, you know, you obviously missed that somehow. That was meant to be funny.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Life should be. We should have some fun in life. You know?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Definitely. Well, talking about fun, I think I've not got any beer in the house, so I think my first thing I'm going to do as soon as we finish this podcast is go and get some beer for tonight.
Excellent. Yeah. Great idea.
Definitely.
Great.
Well, good stuff.
You enjoy that, Kenny.
Yeah, well do. Right.
Thank you, Alan, again. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you for the chance.
Cheers. Cheers, Alan. Speak to you again soon. Cheers.
Right, well, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.